Welcome to the podcast edition of American Warrior Radio with Ben Bueller Garcia, presented by Medicare Mentors. American Warrior Radio, telling the stories of the American men and women who protect us at home and abroad. And now, here is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia.
We all owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I have, on two occasions, been several hundred feet underwater in a steel tube 362 feet long and 33 feet wide. It was a thrill. But for someone like myself, marginally claustrophobic and well-read on military history, it was also a nail-biter. The crew did everything they could to keep us busy and distracted from the fact that venturing underwater is a dangerous business, even in safe waters with no one shooting at you. I was shown the escape trunk, but I couldn't help but harken back to my days fighting forest fires when we were issued emergency shelters. The seasoned firefighter and veterans shared with us young guys that if the time ever came when one had to deploy the shelter, it would probably already be too late. It didn't help that bouncing around in the back of my mind at the same time were some words shared by an engineering crew member on that very same submarine when he was talking to a high school science class the year prior. He told them the greatest threats weren't the enemy, they were fire, hydraulic line breaks, and dive plane malfunctions. By the end of the day, I'd enjoyed an amazing meal in the company of some of the bravest sailors I've ever met. Turns out my only major problem was trying to figure out the correct order of valves to use when flushing the toilet so as not to make a mess. I came away from those cruises with a newfound respect not only for submariners, but for the unforgiving nature of the environment in which they operate. The United States Navy has not lost a submarine since an unexplained catastrophic event took the USS Scorpion in 1968. Now, the Boy Scouts' motto is be prepared. The mission of our Navy's Undersea Rescue Command is to be prepared to mobilize any time to rescue any U.S. or NATO submarine anywhere in the world. Joining American Warrior today to tell us more about this small and very specialized unit and the largest submarine search and rescue mission in world history is Master Chief Patrick Bunker. Pat, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you very much for having us. This is a great honor to be here and be on your show. Thank you so much.
Well, do I call you Chief? Do I call you Captain? What? I get a little confused with all the stuff you do, Pat.
Well, it's actually Master Chief. You just demoted me by two ranks. But that's okay. That's okay. We'll work on it. We'll work on it. Pat is fine, actually.
Oh, and the reason I bring that up is you are a Navy reservist, and your day job is what?
I am a captain on the Tucson Fire Department.
Okay. So you qualify in two areas of the folks we feature on American Warrior Radio. You're a sheepdog and a warrior.
Well, you know, I've had an amazing career with Tucson Fire, just past 34 years, and I've got a couple more years to go. And I love serving the citizens of Tucson and doing what we do, but I also love the military too. I've also been very, very fortunate to be part of the reserves.
Why the Navy, Pat?
Well, quite honestly, the Navy, because they were the ones that gave me the opportunity. I was too old for the Marine Corps. I was the Army really didn't have much interest in me. I actually got rejected from the Coast Guard. So when I joined when I was 36 years old.
I can't help but chuckle because it's I don't think I've ever had a guest say, I joined this branch because nobody else wanted me.
Yeah, you know what? They gave me the opportunity. As a matter of fact, there was a guy that came around to the fire stations. He was handing out pamphlets, and they were looking for corpsmen. They were looking for people that had medical experience, paramedics and EMTs. And I came back over, and I came from a very long military history. I started in the fire service when I was 19 years old, and I didn't really take the opportunity to be in the military. But I watched my dad and my uncles sit around and tell war stories and tell all this other stuff. And I kind of wanted my own stories. Even though I was a firefighter, I really didn't fit into that group when they were in there drinking beers. And so, you know, I talked to my wife and I said, hey, I'm 36 years old. And they told me it's either now or never. And so I joined and I haven't looked back and I've enjoyed every single year of it.
I want to talk more about undersea rescue because as we're talking before the show started, Pat, you and I have known each other a long time. I kind of sort of figured something like this existed, but I had no idea the extent of the command. So I want to talk about that a little bit more. But tell me why your skill set or the skill set like yours are a perfect fit for this particular mission.
Well, and a lot of the military, police, fire, public safety people are in the reserves. And one of the reasons why we fit so well into the Undersea Rescue Command is because it's a rescue operation. It's not a combat operation. And when we have to go down and try to rescue somebody from a disabled sub, there's things that people don't understand is that those people have been down there for quite a while. So we have to get them up a ladder well, into the rescue vehicle, and then up and through all the decompression stuff. And that takes a lot of technical movement. Not only that, they need to be cared for. They're sick, they're injured, mm-hmm. they're hurt. Mm-hmm. So we already have that skill set. With me were four other firefighters from different parts of the country. So we had a very unique, very highly qualified and skilled team to help these sailors out.
Tell us more about Undersea Rescue Command. What is it? How many people are involved? Now it's headquartered out of?
It's headquartered out of North Island in Coronado.
Okay.
We've got about 35 active duty sailors that keep the lights on every day, make sure the equipment is running every day, make sure that they are highly dedicated, highly trained people, thinking about this 24 hours, 7 days a week. And then we have about 65 reservists that supplement that team. If we'd ever have to go onto a submarine rescue like we did, we were going to have plenty of people because those watch schedules are 24 hours a day. When you reach down to the submarine, you get them, you start bringing people up. We can only bring up 16 people at a time. So if you have a Los Angeles class or a Boomer class submarine, you're talking about 120 to 165 people trying to get them out of there. So we have a large watch bill that we have to do, and it's a 24-hour operation. So the reservist comes in and try to help out the active duty folks to do this. Fortunately, we don't have a lot of submarine emergencies. So the command is not as big as, of course, every command wants to be bigger, but this is a pretty good fit for what we do and how we do it.
You know, the connection I always make with you, because you've been very gracious in hosting some of our submariners when they visit Tucson. And I mean, we're a landlocked city. We're nowhere near, well, we're relatively far from an ocean. But I'll never forget that in getting to know the crew members, in particular of the USS Tucson, which is a Los Angeles class submarine, the early statement that everybody on that submarine is a firefighter.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is the number one threat that they have. And so there seems a natural connection with them and folks like yourself that are day job, I use the quotation finger, firefighters.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that was, when you go to Navy boot camp, that's one of the things they concentrate on is shipboard firefighting, just like Marines concentrate on being a rifleman. You know, everybody mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. that ship has to know how to fight fires and things like that. I probably had a little bit of advantage when I went to boot camp and doing this stuff. I wasn't afraid of fire, and I wasn't afraid to, get in there and mix it up a little bit. But yeah, absolutely. That is probably one of the biggest dangers, if not the biggest danger of any ship, is it catching fire. And it's so ironic because you're surrounded by water.
Right.
You know, so it's one of those things that we train everybody to go through. And even through different types of training evolutions, like when we do chief select training and do some other things, we still put them through firefighting paces.
Excellent. When we come back, I want to just sort of tease people. It's really, you know, every military movie ever made, Pat, is 100% accurate, right?
Yeah.
So Hunt for Red October.
Oh, yeah.
100%, yeah?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In the movie, there's a critical scene where they use what's called a DSRV to get on the Red October.
Right.
And so I knew that wasn't completely made up. I knew that equipment existed. But that was actually born out of one of our few submarine disasters, correct? I mean, that technology was developed after the Thresher?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. I mean, one of the things that we thought about, you know, and this is one of the things I do love about the military, is that we think about what if.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have all these things, and submarines are very hard to sink. I mean, they have redundant system built upon redundant system built upon redundant system, but getting them up to the top. So we don't really think that, well, you know what, submarines are necessarily going to fail or they're going to, but there is that possibility. So what happens if they do? How do we get these guys up? Now, throughout the country, although the United States has not had very many submarine accidents, there have been a lot of submarine issues with different countries. Now, a lot of them are diesel boats, and a lot of them don't have the technology that we do, but there's still some problems getting the sailor from inside the submarine to the surface. So that's what that technology was developed off of.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Master Chief Patrick Bunker, United States Navy Reserve, about Undersea Rescue Command, and we're going to talk about just a really powerful subject, sort of discouraging, but it goes to prove what they do. The world's largest submarine rescue mission that took place just a couple years ago. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. I've been doing this 6 years, Pat, and I'm still trying to figure out the kind of hand signals that my producer gives me. Talk now, Ben. Welcome back, folks. We're talking with Master Chief Patrick. See, now you got me all nervous. Also a captain of the fire department. Patrick Bunker, thanks so much for being here on American Warrior today. Exploring something I've always been fascinated by. Of course, I've always been supportive and I love the submarine community. There's a couple of jobs in the world, Pat, that you could not, there's just not enough money to pay me to do. Plumber, Border Patrol agent, and putting me on a submarine. I recounted my brief experience at sea with the USS Tucson, but Undersea Rescue Command, a fascinating, really small group, the only unit in our United States Navy that does what it does.
Yeah, that's correct. We're the only... They're the only people that go down, and their primary job is just to rescue submarines in case they get into trouble.
Now, you also mentioned that there's 11 other countries that have some sort of submarine rescue unit, but we're unique. Why?
Well, the reason why URC is so unique, because we are mobile. We can pack everything up, put everything on C-5, C-17 aircraft, and go to anywhere in the world and start to operate. And that makes us a little bit different. Most of the other submarines that you have are for coastal defense. So they're not worldwide submarine units. They go out there, and so they can have ships that can get up and down their coastline pretty quickly to help out. The problem was that Argentina didn't have a submarine rescue asset.
Now, let's talk about the tools, because I'm going to kind of geek out here, because some of this stuff is very, very cool, but you're based out of San Diego.
Yep.
Is this equipment on both coasts or just all in one place, because it's all got to go together wherever
just
you go to?
Just one coast. It's just in San Diego on North Island. Yep.
I sort of teased before the last break about the DSRVs and the little mini submarines that are designed to mate with the larger submarines. We don't use those anymore. We stopped using that system in 2008, at least for submarine rescue. What do we use now, Patrick?
It's called a pressurized rescue module, and it's a PRM, but it holds 16 rescuees and two attendants, and it's all driven by... you don't have a pilot. You have somebody that's driving it on top, and it goes down and can go down to about 2,000 feet and mate with the disabled sub. The nice thing about that is it's articulating, is that it has the ability that if the sub's kind of on the side or in a different position, that we have the ability to mate with it and still get the people out.
And that's important, because the bottom or wherever this submarine is going to come down is not necessarily a nice flat space. It's not sitting up at 90 degrees. So
right.
You've got to be able to mate with the submarine at
angles.
Yeah. Some of your equipment, I think, can anywhere from 33 to, I want to say, 40, 44 degrees of an angle.
Yeah, something like that. Yep, absolutely. So we can get on there. So we have the PRM. We have that is going to be good from about 800 feet on down to about 2,000 feet. We have another rescue asset that we can use, the submarine rescue chamber. Same technology that we used in 1939. It is the exact same, basically the same model, same thing, maybe upgraded a little bit, but it works out perfectly. It's not very high tech, so it doesn't break a lot. So it's actually actually a good thing. Yeah, it's actually a good thing. So that was one of the things that was on my rescue ship, was the SRC.
Now, when this... either of these units submerges and goes down, Is it remotely operated, or
yes.
is there a crew that goes down with
there,
the?
There are crews that go down there. Both the SRC and the PRM will have two attendants that go down into there with that. So on the initial contact with a submarine, you would go down, you would have a crew with you, and then you would have, you know, you might have 10 or 12 guys that go down that are either medical types or engineers to help with the submarine, fix the submarine, whatever's wrong with it, first of all. They would transfer into the disabled sub, and then you would have another crew. We'd start taking people up and out. So they would be down there to help them out.
Basically. Now, in the materials you provided me, Pat, there's also, looks like just a kind of your more typical remotely operated vehicle. And I found this interesting in its role in that it can help, you know, find the submarine,
right,
or whatever you're looking for. It can help maybe clear some things that need to be cleared in order to get to it. But right. I think I read, if I got this correctly, can it deliver
yes
critical supplies if they're needed immediately?
Yeah.
And
yeah, we can go ahead and we have some tubes that we can sit in there, and we can slide into some of the places in the submarine to get either water or food or medical supplies or tools that we may be until we can get set up and get down there. But yeah, the ROV is one incredible tool that we've been using. And before that, we were doing manned diving. So we would put somebody in what's called an ADS 2000, and they would go down. And it was, if you can imagine what Buzz Lightyear looks like,
right?
And it was that kind of a suit that we go down there. And one of my good friends, Dan Jackson, was the guy that set the record for that. He went down to about, I would say, almost 2,000 feet, and he was able to, operate it down there. He's the first person to do that. So
that is really really deep.
Yeah. He went out there and did some things, and he wasn't supposed to. It was one of those things that the primary suit didn't work, and they were looking at him, and, you know, all the admirals are on board, and they go, "You ready?" He goes, "Oh yeah, we're ready." And he went down there. Yeah. He was an incredible man.
Wow. So if need be, when you deploy, and we're going to talk about the AVA San Juan rescue and specifically, but when you deploy, are you taking everything with you? So I guess my question, maybe better put, if the submarine is at a depth that would accommodate using both pieces of equipment, would you use two at a time to try and get more men up quicker, or is that not, there's just not enough room to... And not enough resources.
We probably, if we knew we had a real rescue, we'd probably take everything we had, just
right.
Because you just never know what you're going to get when you get there. You wouldn't probably use both assets at the same time, because some of the pressure, how it fits onto the hatches and the pressure that you have to have on, so we can do an open hatch dive. Because I'll tell you, the one thing submarines don't like to do is open their hatches. So
not when they're under the water.
Yeah,
no.
When they're under the water,
it's a bad
they have
day.
They get a little nervous about that. So one of the things that we did was depending on the pressures at the sea, and the pressure depends on the depth, and that's one of the things I think people understand. When I first walked into URC, and I knew nothing about submarines, I knew nothing about rescue, that type of rescue, I walked in there and I saw the bells and gadgets and things, and I was like, oh my God, this is going to be really complicated. And it is really complicated, but it looks like a space shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
And you're dealing with incredible amounts of pressure. And we know more about the moon than we actually know about the ocean floor. So the water is the ocean is big uncharted territory for us, and so it's interesting to see all the things we have to do to get the rescue done.
And I'm excited, and this, as I mentioned, my, you know, sort of my trepidation when I was out at sea on the USS Tucson. They showed me the escape trunk. You know, you never want to. That's fine for Navy SEALs or someone like that, but it's like, dude, I'm not. Yeah, I'm a goner if it comes down to that. But the reality, and you touched on the ocean versus the moon. The reality is there's just a whole bunch of the ocean that we still couldn't get to. Period.
Oh, no.
End of discussion.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, rescuable waters for us are almost 10% of the oceans. So I mean, you know, if the submarine goes down from there, it's going to hit crush depth, and there's not going to be a whole lot for us to be able to do. If they can hover and they can't surface, I wouldn't understand a circumstance. And again, I'm not a submariner.
Mm-hmm.
I was a submarine rescue guy. So there may be circumstances. Most of our submarines are going to be able to get, but what I think you're going to see is that there's a lot of different countries that have submarines. And what's going to end up happening, there's like 41 countries that have submarines, and you wouldn't think some of these countries would have them. But what you're going to end up seeing is that the more countries that have submarines, the more accidents that are potential out there. So it's good to have a submarine rescue to go out there and help these people out.
One of the issues, as I understand it, Patrick, with the Kursk, the Soviet submarine, what, and I don't know if it was pride or secrets or whatever it might have been, but they just waited so long before they asked for help. And that was not the case in with Argentina.
No, it really wasn't. With the Kursk, the Russians are a little bit more standoffish, and they want to do things themselves. And that's unfortunate, because the sailors that were trapped back there, we probably could have helped out a little bit more than they were. So if we could have gotten, if we wouldn't have been invited. So that was one of the things that was initially a little bit frustrating, because on the 15th, you know, the submarine comes up missing, and 16th they turned around and, you know, they actually radioed and said they were having problems, and then 16th it comes up missing, and then we were sitting there waiting, and it's like, are you going to ask us for help? Mm-hmm. Because we can't move until they ask us for help. And when they finally asked us for help, I will tell you, it was amazing that how organized and how good things actually went. And in every military operation, you're going to have things that are screwed up. You're going to have things that don't go.
Yeah, but there's an acronym for that.
Yeah. I will tell you, they were, it was exciting to be a part of.
Now that brings up an interesting question for me. In the actual mission statement that folks can find on the interwebs about Undersea Rescue Command, it specifically says U.S. or NATO submarines.
Right.
But it seems, you know, reading history and seeing these things, Pat, it seems to me that this is more of an international. When this happens, everybody stands too.
Right.
I mean, so.
So after the Kursk incident, there was something that's called Ismerlo that came up. And what that is an international 911 for submarines. Okay, they kind of keep track of what's going on. It's a common number that you call up and say, hey, I'm missing a submarine, I need help. And then they start activating all the different rescue assets and things like that to try to find these things. One of the things about the submarines, and you know with the USS Tucson, that is some top secret stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But when submarines get in trouble, all the submarine rescue stuff is not top secret. We will share with anybody. We talk to anybody. We've had the Chinese coming over and looking at our assets. We've had, we've talked to just about everybody. It's like, look, you know, if you're in trouble, let us help you or help us invent a different mousetrap and help us invent better ways to do this. So it's pretty unique thing to be seeing some people that could be potentially adversaries and, you're helping them out, trying to figure out how to rescue the submariners. But that's a special bond between the submariners.
Pat, that's a perfect transition to what I want to talk about next, and that is, I think in your words, for what you sent me, the largest search and rescue operation in the history of world navies involving the AVA San Juan. We'll talk more about that when we come back. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, joined by Master Chief Patrick Bunker. We're talking about Undersea Rescue Command and an amazing mission that he was part of back in 2017. We'll be right back. Back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I finally got the signal straight. He's jumping up and down in the booth and waving his arms. Talk, talk, talk. I'm joined by Master Chief Patrick Bunker. We're talking about Undersea Rescue Command. Patrick is a captain with the Tucson Fire Department, also a Navy reservist. Now, Patrick, you're no longer involved with this command. You've moved on to other things.
Yeah, that's correct. Usually you get into commands, you stay there 3 or 4 years, and then the Navy wants to spread your experience out to other places, and so you kind of go to other places.
You are coming off shift at, I think, 7 in the morning in November of 2017, and your phone rings. Tell us about that phone call.
Yeah, I was walking in my door. I was actually walking my door from a shift on the fire department, and my CEO had called me, and he said, "Hey, stand by. We've got a real world mission." Now, since I had been with URC for the last 4 years, prior to that, we had had two other alerts that had gone down. One lasted about 20 minutes, and because there was an emergency flare that went up from a British submarine. And then the Australians thought they'd collided two submarines together and in a training exercise. And that went on for a couple hours before we stood down, before they had contact with them. But this one was going to be different. And I could just tell by my CEO's voice. He's like, look, he goes, I'm reading traffic. He goes, we need to get ready to go. And of course, I alerted all my people, and it was a phone tree, and it was a Friday. And it was the day that my son came home from his first college, because it was the week before Thanksgiving. And we knew that this had a different tone on it. And then when we started looking at we started looking later on that evening, the news started picking up that there was a submarine that was missing. And so we knew that this was going to be this was going to be a real world mission.
Now, thank you for correcting me. It's the ARA San yeah. Juan, which would make sense given that it's an Argentinian sub. 15 November 2017, the San Juan was in heavy seas. And you gave me a couple of the radio transmissions here, Pat, if you don't mind. Radio transmission number one, they communicated that seawater had... they had trouble with their air snorkel, and they have to... Well, let me back up a little bit, because this is important to this story. One of the things about our submarine force, the U.S. submarine force, they're nuclear-powered. So basically the only thing that... I mean, they can stay down forever
right.
with all the lights and TV on, and the only thing that limits their endurance is food. They right. generate their own water, generate their own oxygen. Diesel electric submarines can't do that.
Right.
So they've got a surface, and they only have so much air... oxygen capacity when they're submerged.
That's correct.
Okay. So they're having trouble with their air snorkel, which is the way they get air when they come up near the surface, that had failed. Then the next transmission, seawater had gone into the battery compartment and there was a fire. And you and I talked about how just what a scary, scary thing a fire in a metal tube underwater can be.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then radio transmission number two, things are still getting worse, continue on course. There was a third radio transmission that was garbled and cut off, and things went downhill from there.
Yeah, I mean, then we lost contact with the submarine at that point in time, and there was no other further communication. The problem was is that we were down there way, way, way towards the South Pole, so we were closer mm-hmm. to the South Pole than we were the equator, and it was heavy seas, 15-foot seas. And the one thing a submarine doesn't like to do is be on the surface, especially in heavy waters. So because they just get rolled back and forth mm-hmm. and it's really miserable for the crew. So I think what the captain was thinking, and we don't know what he was thinking, but he was like, okay, I'm just going to keep at a good distance and I'm going to get underneath the water and I'm just going to continue. So they were coming back from a naval base way on the south part of Argentina and just on a routine mission. And so people are like, well, what does Argentina need a submarine for? Well, until you're out there and see all the massive amounts of fishing that goes on, and then some cases illegal fishing, then they have to they have to protect their borders, they have to protect their fishing ways and that kind of stuff. So that's what they use the submarines for. And when they went missing, that's when every submarine has to make certain contacts at certain times, and that way we know that they're okay. Mm-hmm. And they missed their contact, so and then they missed their second contact. And that's called a submiss. And then when that happens, then things start to get rolled. So Argentina asked us to help them out. And so within 24 hours, we had everybody to the base in San Diego, equipment loaded up and on airplanes coming in from all over the country. We had two C-5s and five C-17s loaded up, and everybody working together, Air Force, Navy, the contractors, everybody trying to pull their weight and get this thing out of there, because we are on the clock.
You know, one thing that really struck me about that, I learn something new every time I have a guest like you on, Patrick, and one thing that really struck me, two things. One, something known as a vehicle of opportunity, mm-hmm. and number two, a division of Undersea Rescue Command where it's like, we don't have time to negotiate. We're just writing checks, period. End of right. discussion. Let's go. So vehicle of opportunity means you find the nearest ship possible that you can do some welding on to get your equipment on board and go to work.
Yeah. Vessel of opportunity.
Okay, back to vessel.
So our contractors, so we have contractors that work with us hand in hand, and those contractors provide us food, lodging, transportation. They help with the vehicle maintenance. They help us do some other things. But with a government contract, you forget that it has to go out to bid. Mm-hmm. Well, what ends up happening is that doesn't work for us. So one of the other things that they do, which is they keep a registry of where all the ships are in the world and who can fit our platform and what they're doing. And, you know, they're civilian ships, they're vessels of opportunity, and we just happened to luck out. We had the Scandi Patagonia, which is a ship that goes out and fixes oil derricks. And it has a lot, it just had great capacity. It was a great ship. We were able to get that. They ordered that ship, they wrote the check. It was pulling into port when we were landing. So we were able to unload everything, get everything on the ship and out of there within about 18 hours. So wow. We were underway in about 18 hours after we hit. We worked all the way through the night, getting things done, getting people in there, welding the deck plates on there so we could get the assets on there.
And again, time is a factor because, as we mentioned, with a diesel electric boat, they only have as much air as they've submerged with. And on this particular submarine, that was, what, 7 to 10 hours?
Yeah, it was about 7 days. So we were sitting
7 days.
Yeah,
okay,
we were sitting there, and there's things that the submariners can do to increase their survivability. There's CO2 blankets that they can put up. There's some oxygen exchange things that they can do. So they're just doing things. But they are limited, and we know that. So what our goal is to be over target and getting things done within 96 hours. And then we can start. We can take the ROV, send it down there with supplies or get the PRM or whatever we need to do to start exchanging stuff to help them to increase their life.
So you're at sea doing a search. The ocean is a very, very big place. And you sent me an example that helped people visualize, for example, the mountains north of our community. You take a school bus, paint it, camouflage, put it up there on the mountain, and then try and find it from 2,000 feet up in the air. It's not easy.
No, it is. It's extremely difficult. And what people don't understand, they see this nice, beautiful flat ocean, but it's mountainous underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's canyons, and there's all sorts of different things that were going on there. And the way the San Juan was traveling, they were traveling right along a ridge where it goes really flat, and then it gets really mountainous. And so we were having a hard time locating where the submarine was at. We were hoping that the captain, knowing that he was in trouble, was going to try to get more to that flat part, but we weren't sure. And then the other thing, too, is that you're trying to find something that's designed not to be found.
Right. Good point.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're trying to find something that is supposed to be stealth, and that is a problem. So, and then you start going down there and you start looking at this stuff, and I'm a big fan of drain the oceans, and you see what all the stuff is underneath it and stuff. Well, that's a huge fishing area out there. So when we were out there, we were getting some views on side scan sonar, and it was like, wow, is that a submarine or not? And we'd prosecute them, and we'd go down and maybe take a little bit better look, and it was either rocks that looked like submarines or it was sunken fishing trawlers because they're littered out there.
Well, and this submarine, the San Juan, it's not a very big boat. I mean, just looking at the pictures, it's not anywhere near the size of like one of our fast attack submarines.
No, so. it only held 44 souls on it, and where ours hold 120. You know, our fast attacks hold 110, 120 people. Our boomers are even bigger than that. So it's not a very big submarine. It was about 30 years old. And it just got done getting refurbished a couple years prior to that.
This might be one of those areas, Pat, where Ben asked a question that can't be answered because it's classified, but on an aircraft, there's the black box.
Right.
Is there no such thing as an emergency beacon on a submarine, or at certain depths, it doesn't matter?
No, there is. There's ways for the crew to communicate with the surface that, hey, I'm in trouble. But the problem, and that was one of the reasons why we were hoping that this wasn't the case, but there was none of that. So what we thought might have happened, one of the scenarios we thought had happened, is that whatever happened, it happened quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So the people couldn't react.
Well, and it's clear from their transmissions they were having trouble with their batteries.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that doesn't help.
And you know, when you're sitting there and you're traveling and you're doing all these things, you're thinking, okay, what could possibly go wrong? What could possibly be the issues? And one of the things that we developed was that when seawater hits the batteries, they will produce chlorine gas. You know, and chlorine's bad. You know, everybody thinks that chlorine's pretty benign because they use it in the pool. Mm-mm. I'll tell you, as a hazardous materials captain, chlorine is a bad cat. So I can only imagine being stuck in that tube and having any kind of chlorine gas. And we're not even sure that is just a theory that could be going off. But we do know that something pretty violent and it happened to it pretty quickly.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Master Chief Patrick Bunker about undersea rescue, and in particular, the unfortunately ill-fated situation of the ARA San Juan. More details when we come back. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We've got Master Chief Patrick Bunker sitting in the studio with us. We're talking about he was involved with the Undersea Rescue Command, not anymore, but he was a very, very unique and specialized group, one of a kind really in the world with the way they do what they do, rescuing submarines around the world. We're talking about the ARA San Juan, which is an Argentinian diesel electric boat that sank in November. Well, submarines are supposed to sink, but it didn't come up again in November of 2017. Pat, you guys are out there and you're facing lots of challenges. One thing that, as I mentioned in my intro, I take great pride in knowing the men who, in our case, men that go to sea on our submarine forces. It's just, there's a huge amount of respect for people that do that day in and day out. It's just a dangerous, dangerous game. But I guess when something like this happens, we talked about it earlier, and everybody just stands to, we got to get these. I mean, a submariner is a submariner, and there's a bond there regardless probably of the country, even with some of our enemies, if you will. But there was two people that deployed with you that it really struck me, the commitment of these folks that go out to save lives. One of them, as I understand it, was expecting a child any time, yeah, in a matter of a couple of days, right?
Yeah.
And I could see where in my world, you know, somebody would call in sick, but
right,
not this guy.
No.
And another one of your crew members, and I find this just startling, was fighting stage 4 cancer.
Yeah.
And he deployed.
Yeah. So Master Chief Dan Jackson, who was instrumental in designing the whole submarine rescue program and designing the modern-day submarine rescue program and designing the TUP program, the Transfer Under Pressure program. He developed a stage 4 cancer back in 2015. And he looked at me, and I'm the senior enlisted leader of the group, and he looked at me and he said, there's no way I'm not going on this. And I looked at him, and I knew what he brought to the table. And I was like, Dan, do you think you can go? You know, do you think there's going to be a problem? He goes, I can go. He goes, I will not be an issue. And we had some physicians with us anyway. And he goes, look, he goes, I got these doctors that can help me out if there's any problems. But he goes, I'm ready to go. And what made this rescue so unique was that this is the first time since 1939 that URC had done its mission, that it turned around and said, holy cow, to go out and rescue sailors or possibility of rescue sailors from a submarine. And there was no way these guys were going to miss it. I got the news that the sailor delivered the baby. Mm-hmm. And the wife was supportive. He goes, you got to go. And you got to remember, this is the week before Thanksgiving. You know, everybody's getting ready to settle down and to kind of go. And I'm going to tell you right now, there was nobody that said, I can't go. There was everybody that said, yeah, we're going, let's go. When are we going? And I'm so proud of them. So proud of every single last one of them that I can't even tell you. And unfortunately, we didn't find. Unfortunately, our time ran out there, and we knew that there was not going to be a rescue. But we just wanted to. We wanted to find the submarine, and then unfortunately, we weren't able to do that. But it was found about a year later.
So, and I want to stand corrected because words are important, and I'll catch a lot of flack from my submarine pals. Submarines are designed to submerge.
Submerge,
not
yes,
to sink. Thank
that's
you.
Right. That's
yeah, they're not supposed to. Yeah. So around the 29th of November, the Argentinian government officially just declared that the sub was lost and the search was being called off. Over 12 days, 30 ships and aircraft searched 186,000, over 186,000 square miles, 40 countries, 4,000 personnel involved. And that's why this historically is the largest submarine search and rescue that we're aware of.
Right. And you got to remember, United Kingdom and, you know, England and Argentina aren't the best of friends.
Yeah, they just
but they were right there.
Yeah.
There was a British destroyer out there looking for things and helping us out. And everybody had one thing in mind. And when we realized that maybe we couldn't save the crew, we just wanted to find some peace for the family and locate the wreckage. And unfortunately, we weren't able to do that. But what was very successful about the mission was the deployment of all the assets, getting things there, proving things, because we had just talked about it on paper. We had never done it before. And then all of a sudden, we're actually getting things done. And I will tell you, if we would have been given the opportunity, we would have saved those guys. There's no doubt in my mind. The brain power that was working and working through what ifs and problems was absolutely inspiring.
Well, eventually, the final resting place of the submarine was 2,976 feet down, which is well beyond the submarine's crush depth of approximately 900 feet. Pat, this might be the hardest question of our entire chat. It is not only a tradition, I think maybe I'd go far as to say a policy of the United States Armed Forces, we don't leave men behind.
Right.
In this case, and given the nature of the seafaring tradition, where, you know, sometimes we bury sailors at sea.
Right.
In this case, even if the technology was available, I assume we just want to leave the remains there on the submarine, or...
You know, the way I think we would look at it is that it would be considered a gravesite. So we've got to be very, very careful. Even when we go out and dive on other shipwrecks and things like that, there's a submarine that sits, a 1900 submarine that sits off the coast of San Diego that we go and prosecute and we look at and we do some things with, and we actually lay reefs on during their anniversary. But it's a gravesite. It's a gravesite. And you know, I felt horrible for the families and the sailors and things. It's never a good thing to see that. But I will tell you, we did our very, very best in getting them and getting some closure with the families. It was amazing. I'll tell you one more quick little thing is that the Sophie CM, my commanding officer, Joe Bell, they actually had to cut the back end of the ship off in order to get the asset done.
Wow.
And when I looked at that, I'm like, it's going to Teague, you're never going to get out of here. And he goes, nope, I'm going to have it done in less than 5 days. He did it in 4. And it was amazing to see.
What, and I love that you said that there were no impossible problems and there were a lot of uncommon solutions in this rescue.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was really neat to see when we were traveling over in the C-5 and people were going, okay, what if this and what if this? How are we going to do this? And how are we going to work the hatches? And how are we going to do this? It was amazing to see people turning around and going, well, if it's too deep for our assets, maybe we'll just drag it. We'll put chains on it and drag it to a safer location. I mean, it was like, wow, I didn't even think of that. So it was pretty cool.
So 44 souls lost their lives on the ARA San Juan in November of 2017, including Argentina's first female submarine officer.
Yeah.
And maybe we've got just about 2 minutes left, Patrick, but to me, one of the more heartbreaking parts of this story that you're telling, the XO of this boat had just...
He had just transferred out. Yeah, he had
like
just transferred.
2 days before the...
It was before this voyage had began, so okay. I don't know exactly how long, but he still lived in the neighborhood of where all the other sailors lived. And he was getting text messages from the family saying, hey, please find him. Please find him. And he was on our ship. And we had the Argentina captain on our ship, and we also had an Argentinian admiral on our ship that was trying to relay back to his command staff what was going on and what we were trying to do. You know, and these are guys, this is a small Navy, so they know these people. These are their friends. And it was really hard for us because, you know, it's Thanksgiving for us. It's all this other things that are going on, and we've got to be very, very mindful to how they're doing. But I will tell you, they were extremely appreciative for all of our efforts and what we tried to do.
Well, God bless you and your fellow sailors for, and the other folks are involved. You know, Air Force, all the other, several other branches were involved, Pat, for I don't know if you'd call it a successful mission or not. I mean, bringing those people up again would have been a great success. But as you mentioned, you did what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, we did what we were trying to do.
Okay, so speaking of Thanksgiving and other special occasions, there's a certain young lady out there that point of personal privilege, Master Chief.
Well, I appreciate
Let's
that.
Let's not forget that.
You know, one of the things that make us click and allow us to do the things we do are our family and our spouses. And it's my 25th wedding anniversary tomorrow. My wife, Teresa, amazing. She's simply amazing, keeping the home fires burning. And just want to say I love you and I appreciate you.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's not very often you get to see a rough, tough Navy Master Chief and firefighting captain get choked up, but that was it. That's one for the books. Patrick, thank you so much for your service, and keep doing what you're doing, brother.
Thanks. I'm just glad it's not recorded or anything.
Oops. Speaking of which, you can find this podcast and over 220 others. Nice transition, Pat. Thanks for that one. At AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Share it with your friends. Follow us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio. We even have a Twitter page at Warrior Radio TUC. If you appreciate what we're doing and you'd like to help us get this message to lots more ears, visit patreon.com/American Warrior Radio. For less than one cup of coffee a month, you can help us expand these messages. We're in Tucson, Phoenix, Colorado Springs. We've got some exciting news hopefully coming up about a fourth market. Ladies and gentlemen, until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.
You've been listening to the podcast edition of American Warrior Radio with Ben Bueller Garcia, presented by Medicare Mentors. American Warrior Radio, telling the stories of the American men and women who protect us at home and abroad. American Warrior Radio airs Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KRDO News Radio 105.5 FM, 1240 a.m. and 92.5 FM, and is available by podcast at KRDO.com. Select the radio tab and click on podcasts.